She knew there wasn't much she could do to stop Jacob from becoming the family patriarch. And indeed, she was as impatient for children as everyone else. Still, she wanted to make this river flow in a direction of her choosing. Zilpah also wished to make the lovely Rachel suffer just a little. Zilpah suspected that Rachel feared her wedding night and encouraged her to confess every worry. The older girl sighed and shook her head in sympathy as Rachel revealed how little she knew about the mechanics of sex. She had no expectation of pleasure, only of pain. So Zilpah told her nervous sister that the shepherd spoke of Jacob's sex as a freak of nature. "Twice the size of that of any normal man," she whispered, demonstrating an impossible length between her hands. Zilpah took Rachel up to the highest pasture and showed her the boys having their way with the ewes, who bleated pitifully and bled. The older sister commiserated with the trembling girl, whispering, "Poor thing," as she stroked Rachel's hair. "Poor female thing." And that was why, on the day of the wedding, Rachel panicked. Jacob's chaste adoration had been pleasant, but now he would demand everything of her, and there would be no way to refuse. Her stomach rebelled, and she retched. She pulled out handfuls of hair. She ran her fingernails down her cheeks until she drew blood. She begged her sisters to save her. "Rachel wept as we tried to dress her for the banquet," Leia said. "She cried, claiming she was unready and unwell and too small for her husband. She even tried that trick with the crushed berries, lifting her skirt and whining that Jacob would kill her if he found moonblood in the nuptial bed. I told her to stop behaving like a child, for she wore a woman's belt." But Rachel wailed and fell on her knees and begged her sister to take her place under the bridal veil. "Zilpah says you will do it," she cried. I was struck dumb, Leia remembered. For of course Zilpah was right. I had not permitted myself to imagine such a thing, that it might be me with him that night. I could barely admit it to myself, much less to my sister, who was not so lovely at that moment, her eyes red from crying, her cheeks streaked with blood and berry juice. First, I said no. He would know at once, for no veil could hide the difference in our height. He would refuse to have me, and then I would be damaged goods, unmarriageable, and nothing to be done but sell me for a slave. But all the while I protested, my heart pounded its own yes. Rachel asked me to do what I wanted more than anything in life. So even as I argued, I agreed. Ada was too ill to help dress the bride that morning, so Zilpah took charge of the plot, rubbing Leia's hands and feet with henna, drawing the coal around her eyes, covering her with baubles. Rachel sat in a corner, hugged her knees to her chest, and shivered as Leia prepared for what was meant to be her wedding night. "I was happier than I had ever been," said Leia. "But I was also filled with dread. What if he turned away from me in disgust? What if he ran out of the tent and shamed me forever?" But something in me believed that he would embrace me. It was a simple banquet with few guests. Two flute players from the village came and went quickly. One of the shepherds brought a gift offering of oil, which he left as soon as he had filled his belly. Laban was drunk from the start, his hand under poor Rudy's dress. He stumbled over his own feet when he led Leia to Jacob's side. The bride, crouched low under her veil, circled the groom three times in one direction, three times in the other. Zilpah served the meal. "I thought the day would never end," Leia said. "I could not be seen through my veil, nor could I see out clearly. But how could Jacob not know it was me? I waited in misery for him to expose me, to jump up and claim he had been swindled. But he did not. He sat beside me, close enough for me to feel the warmth of his thigh against mine. He ate lamb and bread, and drank both wine and beer, though not enough to make him sleepy or stupid. Finally, Jacob stood and helped me to my feet. He led me to the tent where we would spend our 7 days, with Laban following. Hooting and wishing us sons, Leah remembered. Jacob did not move toward me until it had fallen silent outside. Then he removed my veil. It was a beautiful garment, embroidered with many colors and worn by generations of brides who had lived through 100 wedding nights filled with pleasure, violence, fear, delight, disappointment. I shuddered, wondering which destiny would be mine. It was not fully dark inside the tent. He saw my face and showed no surprise. He was breathing heavily. He took off the rest of my clothes, removing first the mantle from my shoulders, untying my girdle, and then helping me as I stepped out of my robes. I was naked before him. My mother told me my husband would only lift up my robes and enter me still wearing his. But I was uncovered. And then, in a moment, so was he, his sex pointing at me. It looked like a faceless Asherah. This was such a hilarious idea, I might have laughed out loud had I been able to breathe. But I was afraid. I sank to the blanket, and he moved quickly to my side. He stroked my hands, and he touched my cheek, and then he was on top of me. I was afraid. But I remembered my mother's counsel and opened my hands and my feet and listened to the sound of my breath instead of his. Jacob was good to me. He was slow to enter me the first time, but he finished so quickly I barely had time to calm down before he fell still and heavy upon me, like a dead man, for what seemed like hours. Then his hands came to life. They wandered over my face, through my hair, and then, oh, on my breasts and belly, to my legs and my sex, which he explored with the lightest touch. It was the touch of a mother tracing the inner ear of her newborn child, a feeling so sweet, I smiled. He looked at my pleasure and nodded. We both laughed. And then Jacob spoke tenderly to his first wife. My own father rarely addressed me, and seemed to prefer my brother's company, he whispered. But once, while we were traveling, we passed a tent where a man was beating a woman. Wife, concubine, or slave, we had no way of knowing. Isaac, my father, sighed, and told me that he had never taken any woman to his bed but my mother, even though she had only given him 2 sons early in their marriage. Rebecca had welcomed him with tenderness and passion when they were first married, because as her groom, he treated her as though she were the queen of heaven and he her consort. Their coupling was the coupling of the sea and the sky, of the rain and the parched earth, of night and day, wind and water. Their nights were filled with stars and sighs as they played the part of goddess and god. Their touches engendered 1,000 dreams. They slept in each other's arms every night, except when it was her time for the red tent or when she gave suck to her sons. That was my father's teaching about husbands and wives, said Jacob, my father, to Leah, my mother, on their first night together. And then he wept over the loss of his father's love. Leah wept out of sympathy for her husband, and also out of relief and joy at her good fortune. She knew that her own mother had cried on her wedding night, too. But those had been tears of despair, for Laban had been a boor from the beginning. Leah kissed her husband. He kissed her. They embraced again and again. And even on that first night, when she was tender from being opened by a man, Leah responded to his touch. She liked the smell of him and the feel of his beard on her skin. When he entered her, she flexed her legs and her sex with a kind of strength that surprised her and delighted him. When Jacob cried out in his final pleasure, she was flooded by a sense of her own power. And when she followed her breathing, she discovered her pleasure, an opening and a fullness that made her sigh and purr. And then sleep as she hadn't slept since she was a child. He called her Inanna. She called him Baal, brother lover of Ishtar. They were left alone the full 7 days and seven nights. Food was set out for them at dawn and at dusk, and they ate with the ravenous hunger of lovers. By the end of the week, they had made love in every hour of the day and night. They were certain they had invented 1,000 new methods for giving and taking pleasure. They had slept in each other's arms. They laughed like children at Laban's stupidity and at Zilpah's strange ways. But they did not speak of Rachel. It was a golden week, every day sweeter, but every day sadder, too. There would never be another time when Leah and Jacob could wander in each other's memories or lounge during daylight in each other's arms. These were the only meals they would ever share, talking and finding in each other kindred spirits for business and family politics. They decided that Jacob would emerge from the week feigning anger. He would go to Laban and say, "I have been duped. I was given strong wine, and you gave me the Harrod and Leah rather than my beloved Rachel. My labor for Rachel was repaid with a swindle for which I demand restitution. And although I spent these 7 days and seven nights with your eldest girl as my duty required, I do not consider her my wife until you make me a dowry in her name, and until Rachel is also mine." And that is precisely what Jacob said when he left the tent. "I will take the maiden Zilpah as dowry for Leah, just as Bilhah will be dowry for Rachel. I will take another tenth of your herd for relieving you of your ill-favored daughter. And to be fair, I will work for you for another 7 months as the bride price for Leah. These are my terms." Jacob made this speech before everyone in camp on the day he and Leah emerged from their seclusion. Leah kept her eyes on the ground as her husband recited the words they had rehearsed the night before, naked, sweating each other's sweat. She pretended to cry while twisting her mouth to keep from laughing. As Jacob proclaimed himself, Ada nodded assent. Zilpah turned white at the mention of her name. Laban, who had spent the week drunk in honor of his daughter's marriage, was so stupefied he could barely sputter a protest before throwing up his hands, cursing the lot of them, and returning to the dark of his tent. Rachel spat at Jacob's feet and stormed off. By the end of the nuptial week, she had come to regret her panic. She had lost forever her position as first wife, and then she had heard the sounds from the bridal tent, laughter and muffled cries of pleasure. Rachel had poured out her sorrow to Bilhah, who took her to see two dogs mating and two sheep, none of whom seemed to suffer in the act. Rachel went to the village and told Inna what had happened. Inna told her tales of passion and pleasure and took Rachel inside her hut and showed her how to unlock the secrets of her own body. When Jacob found Rachel at their accustomed tree, she cursed him soundly, calling him a thief and a bastard, a devil and a pig, who inserted himself into sheep and goats and dogs. She accused him of not loving her. She shrieked that he must have known it was Leah, even when she was veiled, sitting beside him at the wedding feast. He could have stopped it. Why hadn't he? She cried bitterly. When her tears were spent, Jacob held her to his chest until it seemed she was asleep, and told her that she was the moon's own daughter, luminous, radiant, and perfect, that his love for her was worshipful, that he felt only duty toward Leah, who was a mere shadow of Rachel's light, that she, only Rachel, would be the bride of his heart, his first wife, first love. Such pretty treason. So it happened that the day before the next full moon, there was a second wedding feast, even simpler than the first, and Rachel took her turn in the tent with Jacob. I do not know much about that week, for Rachel never spoke of it. No tears were heard coming from the nuptial tent of Jacob and Rachel, which was a good sign. No one overheard laughter either. When the week was over, Rachel crept to the red tent before dawn, where she slept until the following morning. At the first new moon after Leah's bridal week, there was no blood between her legs. But she kept this news to herself, Amid the hurried preparations for Rachel's wedding, it was easy enough to conceal the fact that she did not really need to change her place on the straw or use a rag between her legs when she moved around. 2 days after Rachel entered the nuptial tent with Jacob, Leah went to her mother and put Ada's dry hand on her young belly. The older woman hugged her daughter. "I did not think I would live to see a grandchild," she said to Leah, smiling and crying at once. "Beloved girl, daughter mine." Leah said she kept quiet about her pregnancy to protect Rachel's happiness. Her status as head wife would be assured with the birth of a son, and she knew from the first that she was carrying a boy. But Rachel was furious when she learned that Leah was with child. She thought her sister had kept the news from her as part of a complicated plot to shame her, to assure her own role as first wife, as a way to cause Jacob to abandon her. Rachel's accusations could be heard from as far away as the well, which was a good distance from the tent where she bellowed. She accused Leah of asking Zilpah to help cheat her of her rightful place. She insinuated that Leah was pregnant not by Jacob, but by a hare-lipped, half-witted shepherd who loitered by the well. "You jealous bitch!" Rachel screamed. "You evil-eyed lummox! You only wish Jacob loved you as he loves me, but he never will! I am the one! I am his heart! You are a broodmare, you pathetic cow!" Leah held her tongue until Rachel was finished. Then she calmly called her sister an ass and slapped her face hard, first on one cheek and then on the other. They did not speak a word to each other for months. I suppose it only natural to assume that Leah was always jealous of Rachel. And it was true that Leah did not sing or smile much during Jacob's week with Rachel. Indeed, over the years, whenever my father took my beautiful aunt to his bed, my mother kept her head bent over her work, which grew as her sons increased and as Jacob's labors yielded more wool to be woven. But Leah was not jealous in the way of silly girls in love songs who die of longing. There was no bile in Leah's sadness when Jacob lay with his other wives. Indeed, she delighted in all his sons and had most of them at her own breast at one time or another. She could depend upon Jacob to call for her once or twice in a month, to talk about the herds and for an extra cup of sweet beer. On those nights, she knew they would sleep together, her arms locked around his waist, and the next morning her family would bask in her smile and enjoy something good to eat. But I am rushing my story, for it took years before Leah and Rachel finally learned how to share a husband. And at first they were like dogs, circling and growling and giving each other wide berth as they explored the boundary between them. Even so, at first it seemed a kind of parity would prevail, because at the next new moon, Rachel too found she had no use for the rags or the hay. Both sisters were pregnant. The barley crop was enormous. The shepherd slapped Jacob on the back and joked about his potency. The gods were smiling. But just as Leah's belly began to swell against her tunic, Rachel started to bleed. Early one morning, nearly 3 months after her wedding, she woke the whole camp with her cries. Leah and Zilpah rushed to her side and found her sobbing, wrapped in a bloody blanket. No one could comfort her. She would not let Ada sit with her. She would not permit Jacob to see her. For a week she huddled in a corner of the red tent, where she ate little and slept a dreamless, feverish sleep. Leah forgave Rachel her nasty words and grieved for her. She tried to tempt her with her favorite sweets, but Rachel spat at the food and at Leah, who seemed to grow bigger and rounder every day, and as beautiful as she had ever been. "It was so unfair, so sad," said Bilhah, who finally got Rachel to eat a few olives and coaxed her out of the stained, stiff blanket. Bilhah was the one who walked to the village where Inna lived to see if the midwife had some potion that might rouse her sister from her half-death. Inna herself came back and spent hours with Rachel, washing her, feeding her tiny bits of bread dipped in honey, coaxing her to take sips of an aromatic red mead, Inna whispered secret words of comfort and hope into Rachel's ear. She told her that bearing children would not be easy for her, but foretold that someday Rachel would bear beautiful sons who would shine like stars and assure her memory. Inna promised to put all her skills to work to help Rachel conceive again, but only if she would do exactly what the midwife told her to do. That is why, when Leah, in her sixth month, sought her sister's blessing, Rachel put her hands on Leah's belly and caressed the life there. Rachel cried in her sister's arms, kissed Ada's hands, and asked Zilpah to comb her hair. She took Bilhah aside, embraced her, and thanked her for bringing Inna. It was the first time Rachel had thanked anyone for anything. The next morning, Leah and Rachel, side by side, walked out of the darkness of the red tent and back into the light of the world where Jacob stood. Rachel said he wept when he saw them together, but Leah said that he smiled. Leah's first birth was not especially difficult, said Rachel. By the time she told me the story of Reuben's arrival, my aunt had seen hundreds of babies born. And though Rachel would forget where she put her spindle the moment she put it down, she remembered the details of every birth she ever witnessed. She told me that even though Leah's travail began before sunset and did not end until daylight, it was a straight path. His head was down, and her hips were wide enough. Still, the heat of that summer night in the red tent was stifling, and none of the sisters had ever seen a birth. Truly, Leah suffered most because of her sister's fear. It began slowly in the afternoon, with small grabbing pains in her back. Leah smiled after each little seizure, glad to be started, eager to be admitted to the sisterhood of mothers, confident that her body, so broad and big, would fulfill its purpose. She sang in the early stages, children's songs, ballads, lullabies. But as the night wore on, and the moon rose in the sky and then started to sink, there were no more smiles or songs. Each contraction took Leah up and wrung her out, like a bit of cloth, and left her panting and fearful of the next pain. Ada held her hand. Zilpah muttered prayers to Anat. I was of no use at all, Rachel remembered. I wandered in and out of the tent, eaten up by jealousy. But as the hours came and went, each one harder than the last, my envy waned, and I was horrified by the pain I saw on Leah, the strong one, the invincible ox who was on the ground, trembling and wide-eyed. I was terrified by the thought that I might have been in her place, that I might yet be. And I'm sure that the very same thoughts made Zilpah and Bilhah shudder and keep silence when our sister labored. Bilhah finally realized that they needed more help than Ada could provide, and she went to fetch Inna, who arrived at daybreak. By that time, Leah was whimpering like a dog. When Inna arrived, she put her hands on Leah's belly and then reached up inside her. She made her lie on her side and rubbed her back and thighs with a mint-scented oil. Inna smiled into Leah's face and said, "The baby is nearly at the door." And while she emptied her kit, she bade the women gather around to help their sister bring the baby. It was the first time I'd seen a midwife's kit, Rachel said. The knife, the string, reeds for suction, amphorae of cumin, hyssop, and mint oil. Inna put her two bricks on the ground and told Leah she would stand on them soon. She moved me and Zilpah on either side to lend support when Leah squatted over a bed of clean straw. Zilpah and I became Leah's chair, with our arms around her shoulders and beneath her thighs. You lucky girl, Inna said to Leah, who by then did not feel the least bit lucky. Look at the royal throne of sisters you have. Inna talked and talked, banishing the frightened silence that had made a wall around Leah. Inna asked Ada about her aches and pains, and teased Zilpah about the tangled mat of her hair. But whenever a contraction came, Inna had words for Leah only. She praised her, reassured her, told her, "Good, good, good, my girl. Good, good, good." Soon, all of the women in the tent joined her in repeating, "Good, good, good," clucking like a clutch of doves. Inna began to massage the skin around Leia's bottom, which was swollen out of shape. She rubbed with stronger and stronger motions as the pains came closer and closer. And then she put Rachel's hand on Leia's belly and showed her how to press downward, gently but firmly, when the time came. She told Leia not to push, until Leia bellowed curses. Rachel said, "I saw that baby come into the world as I had seen nothing before in my life, clearly, without a thought to myself. I thought of my own mother who had seen this so many times, whose hands had guided so many souls into the world, but who died giving me life. But I had no time to be sorry for myself, because suddenly a strange red bubble emerged from between Leia's legs, and then, almost immediately, a flood of bloody water washed down her thighs. Leia tried to stand, terrified, but Inna told her not to take her feet off the bricks. This was good, she said. He was coming. Leia pushed, her face red, her eyes bulging blue and green, glittering. Her legs were trembling as though they would buckle at any moment, and it took all of Zilpah's and Rachel's strength to hold her. Then Inna told Bilha to take Rachel's place so she could catch the baby. Perhaps the birth blood would rouse Rachel's womb to fill again, too. And so Rachel washed in the river of life. Leia roared and delivered her son. He was so big it took both Inna and Rachel to catch him, and he started to cry even before they raised up his head. No need for the reeds to clear out this baby's nose and mouth. They all laughed, tears streaming down their faces, panting from the effort of Leia's birth. They passed the baby around the tent, wiping him and kissing him, praising his limbs, his torso, his head, his little sex. They all talked at the same time, making more noise than any six women can make. Jacob cried out to the women to tell him the news. "You are a father," said Inna. "Go away. We will send for you soon. And then you will see your son, your firstborn, when we have finished." They heard Jacob shout with joy and call out the news to Laban and Rudy and his barking dogs and the clouds in the sky. The afterbirth fell out of Leia, who was nearly asleep with exhaustion. Inna made her drink and eat before she rested and put the baby to Leia's breast where he nursed. Mother and son slept, and the sisters covered them. Ada watched, a grandmother's smile lingering even after she dozed off. Inna wrapped the placenta in an old rag, and they buried it that night, in the eastern corner of the Bama, as befits a firstborn son. A few hours later, when Leia awoke, she named the baby Reuben. It was a joyful shout of a name that fairly dared evil spirits to do him any harm. But Leia had no fears for her strapping boy. Jacob was sent for and greeted his son with great tenderness. As Jacob walked away from his first meeting with his son, his happiness seemed to evaporate. His head sank to his chest as he contemplated what had to be done next. According to the custom of his family, the boy had to be circumcised, and there was no one to do it but him. Jacob would not let Laban touch the baby, much less take a knife to him. He knew of no other man in the village or nearby hills who knew how, much less why, he would do this to his firstborn son. It would have to be him. Jacob had seen his father cut the foreskins from his bondsman's baby boys, and he had not looked away or even winced when it was done. But he had never done this himself, nor, he now realized, had he watched carefully enough how his father had dressed the wound. And of course, he had never cared so much for any baby in his life. It had to be done, though, and he began the preparations, which Zilpah watched and reported to Leia, who was sick at the prospect of having her baby, her prize, put on the altar of the Bama and mutilated, for that's what she considered it. The flap of skin on the penis meant nothing to her. Indeed, now that she had seen the look of an uncircumcised man, she preferred the look of Jacob's sex, exposed, clean, audacious even, to the tiny shroud her son wore on his member, which was the source of many silly and crude jokes in the red tent. Once Leah threatened to take a bit of charred wood and draw a face upon Reuben's sex, so that when Jacob retracted the foreskin, he would drop his knife in wonder. The women rolled around on the mats, holding their sides, laughing about the tender equipment that men carried between their legs. But after a few days, the joking stopped, and Leah cried so long and so hard over the boy at her breast that the dark curls on his head were salted with tears. Still, she did not object to the custom of her husband's father. Jacob had survived this, she told her sisters again and again, mostly to reassure herself. Isaac had been circumcised, and Abram before him. Nevertheless, the thought of her baby in pain and in danger made the new mother tremble, and the realization that Jacob had no experience at the task put her in a frenzy of worry. Zilpah watched and saw that Jacob was not at ease about the ritual either. Every night he sat on the bama with his knife and sharpened it on the altar, from sunset till moonrise, 3 nights running, until the edge was perfect. He honed and polished the blade until it could cut a hair from his head with the slightest motion of his wrist. He asked Ada to make small bandages woven of new wool taken from the first shearing of the firstborn lamb of the season. He sent word to Leah, inquiring whether she had any of the midwife's unguents to aid in healing. On the 7th night after Reuben's birth, Jacob sat up, silently watching the sky until sunrise. He poured libations and sang to the God of his fathers. He poured libations over the Asherah, too, and opened his hands before her. Zilpah watched all of this, and afterward stopped referring to Jacob as that new man, and began to call him by his name. At dawn of the 8th day after his son's birth, Jacob killed a kid and burned it on the altar. He washed his hands, rubbing them red with straw, as though he had handled a corpse, and then he walked to the red tent and asked that the women give him Reuben, the son of Leah. He called for Laban to follow him, and the two men walked alone to the bama, where Jacob undressed the baby, whose eyes were open, and placed him on the altar. Jacob sighed a loud, long sigh as he stripped the boy, and then he signaled Laban to grab the baby's legs. At this, Reuben began to wail. Jacob took the knife in his hands and knotted his brow. "There were tears in his eyes," said Zilpah. "He took the baby's sex in his hands and pulled the skin up tightly, holding it between the two long fingers of his left hand. With his right hand, he cut with a quick, sure stroke, as though it was an old custom of his, as though he knew what he was doing," she said. Reuben howled, and Jacob dropped the knife. Quickly he bound the wound with Ada's bandage and swaddled the baby, badly, the way men do. He carried his son back to the women, whispering into Reuben's perfect ear words that no one else could hear. The red tent, which had been quiet during the baby's absence, now burst into activity. Leah dressed the wound with the cumin oil that Anna had left for her own birth wounds. Ada swaddled Reuben properly and gave him back to his mother, where he took her breast with relief and then slept. The baby healed quickly, as did Leah during her first month as a new mother inside the shelter of the red tent. She was pampered by her sisters, who barely let her feet touch the earth. Jacob came by every day, carrying freshly dressed birds for her meals. Through the hairy wall of the tent, they relayed the news of their days with a tenderness that warmed those who overheard them. Ada beamed that whole month and saw her daughter step out of the red tent restored and rested. She delighted in her grandson's first yawns and sneezes and was the first to notice Reuben lift his head. Ada held the baby whenever Leah would put him down, and the joy of him lifted years from her face and the pain from her bones. But the illness that had wasted her strength could not be cured by even the greatest joy. And one morning, she did not rise from her blanket. Ada was the only mother any of the sisters had known, and they put ashes in their hair and honored her. Leah washed Ada's face and hands. Zilpah combed her hair smooth. Rachel dressed her in the finest tunic they owned, and Bilha placed Ada's few rings and bangles on the withered wrists, neck, and fingers. Together, they crossed her arms and bent her knees so that she looked like a sleeping child. They whispered wishes into her ears so she could carry them to the other side of the light, where the spirits of her ancestors would greet her soul, which could now rest in the dust of the earth and suffer no more. They wrapped her in a shroud of unbleached wool lined with sweet-smelling herbs and buried her amid the roots of the big tree where the women often gathered to watch the moon rise. Jacob dug the grave while Laban stood and watched, ashes on his head to honor his first wife. With Ada, Laban buried his youth, his strength, and perhaps some forgotten better self. He threw the first handful of dirt, then turned and walked away before the four sisters finished tucking her in with earth, flowers, and loud lamentation. 2 months after Ada died, Bilha entered the red tent. With Ada gone and no other elder to take the part, Leah, nursing her son, became the welcoming mother. She greeted the acolyte and taught her how to manage the flow of blood, how to rejoice in the dark of the moon, how to join her body's cycle with a repetition of life. The wheel had turned, and even though Laban retained title as head of the clan, Jacob's time as patriarch had begun. My mothers, too, began numbering their days with the wisdom of women. There followed many good years. The rains came in season, and the well water was sweet and abundant. The land was spared pestilence, and there was peace among the surrounding tribes. The herds prospered so that Jacob could no longer manage the work alone, and he contracted with Shibtu, the third son of a local shepherd, as a 7-year bondsman. And then he hired Nomir, who brought a wife, Zibatu, and there was a new face in the red tent. The family's good fortune and increasing wealth were not entirely the result of Jacob's skill, nor could it all be attributed to the will of the gods. My mother's labors accounted for much of it. While sheep and goats are a sign of wealth, their full value is realized only in the husbandry of women. Leah's cheeses never soured, and when the rust attacked wheat or millet, she saw to it that the afflicted stems were picked clean to protect the rest of the crop. Zilpah and Bilha wove the wool from Jacob's growing flocks into patterns of black, white, and saffron that lured traders and brought new wealth. This was also the time of great fertility among the women. Many babies were born, and most survived. Leah wore the mantle of the Great Mother, seemingly always pregnant or nursing. 2 years after Reuben's birth, she bore a second son, Simon. Levi was born only 18 months later. Leah miscarried after that. But within another year, her sorrow was forgotten in the joy of her fourth son, Judah. Those brothers, so close in age, were a tribe unto themselves. Reuben, always the heaviest and tallest, was gentle with the younger ones. Simon was a demon, handsome and smug, demanding and rude, but forgiven everything for his dimples. Levi was a meek mouse, and Simon's slave. Judah was a quiet boy, affectionate toward everyone. He was much fairer than his brothers, and Jacob told Leah that he resembled his own brother, Esau. While Leah was carrying Simon, Laban's Rudy showed a big belly too, and bore a boy, Kemuel, who was followed a year later by Beor. The old man doted on his slope-browed sons, who played rough and tumble with Leah's boys at first, but then invented a secret language which locked them into a narrow world of their own making. Laban thought this demonstrated his son's superiority, but the rest of the family saw it as proof of their stunted nature and limited prospects. The happy noise of children surrounded them, but the blessing of generation was not equally distributed. Rachel miscarried again and again. After the bloody flood washed away her hopes a fourth time, she sickened with a fever that drove her out of her mind for 3 days and nights. This frightened her sisters so badly, they insisted she stop trying to conceive, and persuaded her to drink the infusion of fennel seed that seals the womb, at least until she had regained weight and strength. Rachel, exhausted, agreed. But she could not rest long amid the clamor of her sister's sons. Although she no longer hated Leah with the full force of the past, Rachel could not smile at her sister while her own body remained fruitless. She was often away from the family's tents, seeking the counsel of Inna, who had a seemingly endless list of concoctions and strategies to open her womb. Rachel tried every remedy, every potion, every rumored cure. She wore only red and yellow, the colors of life's blood and the talisman for healthy menstruation. She slept with her belly against trees, said to be sacred to local goddesses. Whenever she saw running water, she lay down in it, hoping for the life of the river to inspire life within her. She swallowed a tincture made with bee pollen until her tongue was coated yellow and she peed a saffron river. She dined upon snake, the animal that gives birth to itself year after year. Of course, when anyone, adult or child, found a mandrake, the root that looks so much like an aroused husband, it would be brought to Rachel and handed over with a wink and a prayer. Reuben once found an especially large one and brought it to his auntie with the pride of a lion hunter. But mandrakes did nothing for Rachel's womb. During her quest for a child of her own, Rachel assisted Inna and became her apprentice. She learned what to do when the baby presented itself feet first, and what to do when the baby came too fast and the mother's flesh tore and festered. She learned how to keep a stillborn's mother from giving up her spirit in despair, and how, when a mother died, to cut open the womb and save the child within. Rachel brought her sisters stories that made them weep and sigh and wonder, of a mother who died and a father who sold the infant before her body was cold, of a man who swooned at the death of a beloved wife, of a woman who cried blood for her dead child. She told of potions that worked a miracle upon one woman and seemed to kill another, of an armless monster left out to die in the night air, of blood that carried off and blood that healed. There were triumphant stories, too, of healthy twins, of a baby born blue, the cord wrapped tight around its neck, brought to life by Inna, who sucked the death from the little one's nostrils with a river reed. Sometimes Rachel made her sisters laugh with imitations of women who roared like lions, and others who held their breath and fainted rather than make a peep. Rachel became their link to the larger world. Along with tales of life and death, Rachel brought back new herbs for seasoning vegetables, recipes for unguents that healed wounds, and ever stranger remedies for her own barrenness, all of which failed. Often Rachel returned wearing a bracelet, a bowl, or a skein of wool, tokens of gratitude for her generosity at childbed. The imperious beauty became a tender-hearted healer in the service of mothers. She wept at every birth, the easy, happy ones, as well as the ones that ended with keening and whimpering. She wept with Rudy, and even with Leah. When it came time for Zebatu to stand on the midwife's bricks, Rachel alone, without Inna, led her through the ordeal, tied off the cord, and flushed with pleasure when she held her first, the baby that conferred upon her the title of midwife. Leah cooked her a feast that night, and Zilpah poured out salt and wine before her in recognition of her new status as a servant of women in the name of Anat, the healer. As time passed, more bondsmen came to live and work for Jacob, and with them came women who bore children and lost children. Zebatu gave birth to Nasi, but then lost her second child, a girl who came 2 months before her time. Iltani bore twin girls who thrived, though she died of fever before her daughters knew their mother's face. Lamasi gave birth to a son, Zinri, but her daughter was left out to die because she had the hare lip. In the red tent, we knew that death was the shadow of birth, the price women pay for the honor of giving life. Thus our sorrow was measured. After Judah's birth, Leah grew tired. She, who had always risen the earliest and retired last, who seemed most content when doing two things at once, stirring a pot while nursing or grinding grain as she oversaw the spinning, began to stagger in the afternoons and see shadows where there were none. Inna advised her to leave off bearing for a while and brought her fennel seeds and also showed her how to fashion a pessary out of beeswax. So Leia rested. She rejoiced in the sturdiness of her sons and stopped every day to caress them and play their game of smooth stones. She baked honeyed cake as she used to and planned a new garden where herbs would attract more bees to nearby hives. She slept soundly at night and rose in peace every morning. Leia remembered her fallow years as a time of great contentment. She held the fullness of every day in her hands, numbering the sweetness of children, the pleasure of work. She gave thanks for the fennel seeds and the wisdom to use them. Her cake never tasted sweeter than it did that year, and she responded to Jacob's body with more ardor than she had felt for years. When she spoke of that time, Leia said, "The flavor of gratitude is like the nectar of the hive." After 2 years, she put away the fennel seeds and pessary and conceived another son, whom she bore easily and named Zebulun, by which Leia meant exalt, because with his birth, Leia exalted in her body's ability to heal and to give life once more. She adored the new baby nearly as much as her firstborn. And when she handed her son over to Jacob for the circumcision, she smiled into her husband's face, and he kissed her hands. Chapter 3. Rachel grew quiet. She stopped attending Inna and did not rise from her blanket until Leia shook her and insisted she help the rest of the women in their work. Only then would Rachel spin or weave or work the garden, but wordlessly and without a smile. Jacob could not rouse her from her sadness. Rebuffed by her unbending silence, he stopped calling her to him at night. Her sorrow became a presence so bleak, even the babies began to avoid their pretty auntie. Rachel was alone in her own black night. Bilhah saw Rachel's despair and went to her where she huddled on her blanket. The little sister lay down beside Rachel and held her as gently as a mother. "Let me go to Jacob on your behalf," said Bilhah in a whisper. "Let me bear a son on your knees. Let me be your womb and your breasts. Let me bleed your blood and shed your tears. Let me become your vessel until your time comes, for your time will yet arrive. Let me be your hope, Rachel. I will not disappoint you." Rachel made no reply. She said nothing for a long time. Bilhah wondered if her sister had slept through her words or whether her offer had offended. Bilhah said she waited so long for a reply that she began to wonder whether the words that had been gathering in her heart had not even passed her lips. Bilhah was accustomed to silence and waited. Finally, Rachel turned and kissed her, gathering the small woman close to her body, taking comfort from her warmth. "And the tears she shed were not bitter or even salty," said Bilhah, "but sweet as rainwater." Bilhah knew that even though her offer to Rachel was made out of love, it also served her own heart's desire. She understood Rachel's longing, because it was her own. She was well into her childbearing years. The sounds of lovemaking in the close world of our tents had roused her at night, leaving her shaken and sleepless. Attending her sister's births made her wish to become part of the great mother mystery, which is bought with pain and repaid with an infant's sparkling smile and silken skin. Her breasts ached to give suck. Honest Bilhah revealed every corner of her heart to Rachel, who knew the emptiness her sister described. They wept together and slept in each other's arms. The next morning, Rachel sought out Jacob and asked that he sire a child upon Bilhah in her name. This was not a request, for it was Rachel's right to have a child of Jacob. There was no other permission to seek or get. Jacob agreed. Why would he not? Leah nursed her latest son, and Rachel's back had been turned to him for long months. So that night, on the full moon of a chill month, Bilhah went to Jacob and left him the next morning, no longer a maiden, though not a bride. There was no henna for Bilhah's hands, no feast, no gifts. There were no 7 days to learn the secrets of Jacob's body or the meaning of his words. When the sun rose the next day, Jacob returned to oversee the flocks, and Bilhah went to Rachel and recounted every detail of her night to her sister. Years later, she told it to me. She wept when she entered Jacob's tent, and she was surprised by her own tears. She had wanted to be initiated into the mystery of sex, to open her legs and learn the ancient ways of men and women, but she was lonely walking into her husband's tent alone, without sisters or ceremony or celebration. She had no right to the rituals of a dowered bride, and yet she missed them. Jacob was kind, Bilhah remembered. He thought my tears were a sign of fear, so he held me like a child and gave me a woolen bracelet. It was nothing. No precious metal or ivory or anything of value. Just a woven braid made from leavings, the kind of thing shepherd boys make absent-mindedly, sitting under a tree in the heat of the day out of tufts of wool caught on brambles or blown to the ground. Jacob had twirled the brown, black, and cream-colored strands against his thigh until he had enough to plait into a braid. He took the simple thing from his arm and cut it to fit hers. Such a sad little nothing of a bride price. But she wore it throughout her first year as Jacob's third wife, until it fell apart one day and she lost it without even knowing where. Thinking of her bracelet, Bilhah smiled and with her forefinger traced the place where a bit of string had tied her to Jacob. He comforted me with that poor gift without a word, and I stopped crying. I smiled into his face, and then, oh, I was so bold. I could hardly believe it was me. I put my hand upon his sex and laid his hand upon mine. He lifted my skirt and massaged my belly and my breasts. He buried his face between my thighs, and I almost laughed out loud at the shock of pleasure. When he entered me, it was as though I had fallen into a pool of water. It was as though the moon were singing my name. It was all I had hoped for. I slept in Jacob's long arms, cradled like a child for the first time since my mother held me. May her name be set in the stars. For that night alone, I loved Jacob. Bilhah told all of this to Rachel. It was not easy for my beautiful aunt to hear it, but she insisted that Bilhah leave nothing out, and the younger sister repeated her story as often as Rachel asked to hear it, until the memory of Bilhah's consummation became Rachel's own memory, and her sister's pleasure and gratitude became part of her own feelings for Jacob. The day after Jacob knew Bilhah for the first time, he was called away to do business with a trader in Carchemish, a journey of 2 days. Bilhah suffered in his absence, for she was eager to lie with him again. Rachel suffered in the knowledge that Jacob had found happiness with Bilhah. Leah suffered because she felt so distant from her sister's lives. Zilpah watched it all, said little, and sighed much. Upon Jacob's return, he brought Rachel a beaded necklace and spent his first night with her. Leah was still nursing, so he called Bilhah to him again often during the next months, especially when Rachel was away attending a birth. Jacob and his third wife spoke very little when they were together, but their bodies joined in straightforward postures, which yielded them both pleasure and release. "Jacob said I gave him peace," said Bilhah, with great satisfaction. Bilhah conceived. Rachel greeted the news with kisses and rejoiced with her sister. As the months passed and her belly grew, Rachel coddled her and asked her to name every sensation, every twinge, every mood. Did Bilhah know at what moment life had taken root? Was the tiredness of pregnancy felt in her knees or in her eyes? Did she crave salt or sweet? The two of them shared a blanket during Bilhah's pregnancy. The barren woman felt the slow swell of her sister's belly and the gathering heaviness of her breasts. She watched the flesh stretch in tan bands across the brown belly and thighs, and noticed the changing color of her nipples. As the child grew in Bilhah, draining her of color and energy, Rachel bloomed. She grew soft and round along with Bilhah, and the hollows that sadness had carved in her cheeks disappeared. She laughed and played with her nephews and the other children of the camp. She baked bread and made cheese without being asked. She lived so deeply inside Bilhah's pregnancy that during the 9th month, Rachel's ankles grew swollen. And when the time came for the baby to enter the world, Rachel called Inna to be midwife so that she alone could stand behind Bilhah during her travail and hold her and suffer with her. Happily for Bilhah, the birth was as simple and quick as the pregnancy had been difficult. After a morning's worth of panting and groaning, she stood on the bricks while Rachel crouched around her. Bilhah's elbows rested on Rachel's splayed knees, and it was as if the two women shared a womb for the awful hour when the baby pushed his way out. Their faces strained and reddened together, and they cried out with a single voice when his head appeared. Inna said it was though a two-headed woman had given birth, and declared it one of the strangest things she had seen. When the boy was delivered and the cord severed, Rachel held him first, her eyes streaming for a very long time. Or so it seemed to Bilhah, who bit her tongue and waited for the moment she would embrace the first issue of her womb. Bilhah's eyes followed Rachel's every move as she wiped the blood from the baby's body and checked to see that he was whole and unblemished. Bilhah barely breathed as the moments passed and her arms remained empty, but she said nothing. By law, this son belonged to Rachel. Years attending so many births had made Rachel's heart tender, and with a great sigh, she placed the boy in Bilhah's arms, where he lifted his eyes to his mother's face and smiled into her eyes before he took her breast. At that instant, Rachel woke from her dream and saw that the baby was not her child. Her smile faded, and her shoulders sagged, and her hands clawed at her girlish breasts. Inna had told Rachel that if she let the baby suck there long enough, he would find milk within her, and she could become his milk mother. But Rachel had no faith in her body's ability to sustain life. Putting a child to nurse on an empty breast would cause suffering to her son, who was not hers at all, but Bilhah's. Besides, Bilhah might sicken and even die if she did not empty her breasts, for she had seen that happen. And Rachel loved her sister. She hoped the baby at Bilhah's breast would be as good a man as his mother was a woman. Rachel left Bilhah with her son and went to find Jacob. She told her husband that the baby's name was Dan, which means judgment. To the woman who bore him, Dan sounded sweet, but to her in whose name he was born, it had a bitter ring. The sight of the baby in Bilhah's arms, day after day, shattered Rachel's confidence again. She was only the aunt, the bystander, the barren one. But now she did not rail against heaven or plague her sisters with temper. She sat, too unhappy to weep, under the acacia tree, sacred to Inanna, where the birds gathered at dawn. She went to the Asherah and prostrated herself before the wide-mouthed grinning goddess and whispered, "Give me children or I will die." Jacob saw her suffering and gathered her to him with the greatest tenderness. And after all the years, all the nights, all the miscarriages and broken hopes, Rachel found delight in his arms. I really had no idea why Leah and Bilhah sought out Jacob's bed before those days, Rachel said. I had always gone to his bed willingly enough, but mostly out of duty. But after Dan opened Bilhah's womb, somehow my own passion finally matched Jacob's, and I understood.